The Creative Business Podcast is brought to you by Noosey. Online proposals made simple for creative businesses. Visit noosey.com to learn how your business can start winning more projects today.
Hello and welcome to the Creative Business Podcast. The podcast aims to help you build a better, more successful creative business. Well, hello and welcome to a new episode. You may well have noticed that we've been away, or rather I've been away for a few weeks. We bought a new house just before Christmas and moved in, and unfortunately found that we had an internet speed that was sort of more relevant to the 90s perhaps. But we're back again. Today I'm actually going to be joined by my very first guest on the Creative Business Podcast, who is Marcus Blankenship. How you doing, Marcus?
Good, Nathan. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you back again, man. It's not even the second time I think we've spoken on podcasts, is it?
No, you reminded me that we did do that original one together. That was a long time ago.
It seems like a world ago now. But so it's great to have you back. I mean, I should probably explain that Marcus and I are going to do a few shows together over the coming weeks and months. They won't all be in order. We'll be splitting them up and moving them around. And part of the reason I wanted to get Marcus to come on and do a few shows with me is, A, we get on great, you know, and it's always great to talk to Marcus. He's a great conversationalist, but he also has a tremendous amount of experience as well in the creative businesses, you know, agencies, with developers, designers, everything, you name it. He's probably done a little bit. So why don't you give us a little bit of a background, Marcus, to, you know, why have I invited you to come back?
Sure. Well, I hope you've invited me because we have such a good time together. And that's my goal today, is that maybe people learn a little something and they're thinking, their brains were wrinkled a little bit in new ways because they've thought some thoughts they hadn't had. And at the end of the day, I'll have a good time and so will you. But, you know, I had a creative agency, we called it a digital marketing agency at the time. And we did design and development, and I'll be honest, we even did a little bit of print when we were really desperate and hungry, but we did all kinds of stuff. And then that failed, which really stinks. So if you're listening and you're like, oh, can I survive a failure of my business? You can. It can happen. Maybe we can talk about that on another show.
Let me just stop you right there, because you say fail as if it was just a categorical fail. I mean, we should probably, you know, a caveat there. You did make significant sort of, it was a very successful agency before you decided to close it down.
We, you know, I like to think so. I mean, we got to $1 million and we had 11 people and 20 contractors and a shiny office, and we invested in a sign. So all those kinds of marks of success. But, you know, at the end of the day, the thing that actually failed, to be honest, was the partnership. It wasn't about the clients or the work or the employees. It was really about the partnership, which taught me a lot about partnering with people, and some hard lessons I probably will remember for the rest of my life. But I can tell you that having gone through that, a lot of folks find it pretty interesting to say, you know, how can I make sure my agency doesn't fail or my company doesn't fail in the same way? And I think it'd be kind of fun to talk about one of the things that I see as a pain point. I'm just going to kind of toss this out, because what if we talk today about this idea of some really painful client relationships? Is that a good topic for today?
I think most people could relate to that.
I think, isn't there a whole podcast called Clients from Hell?
Clients from Hell and their website. Yes, I'd say they're pretty successful. Yeah, there's enough horror stories sort of out there, I think. Yeah, we can all relate to that.
Yeah, I think they're really interesting, because I've had my share. I bet you've had your share. And if you're listening and you're sitting there thinking, well, I've never had one of these clients for hell. How do I get one? Or how do I avoid
Where can
them?
I get one?
Where can I get one? This might only be your second or third day in business, because I promise they'll come along.
I'm guessing as well, like, especially at an agency level, you probably see more of those than perhaps the sort of solo freelance consultant.
I don't know. I think that there's bad clients. And let me just back up, because I have this weird philosophy that there's actually no bad clients. We teach people how to be bad clients as a freelancer, as an agency owner, as a creative or a technical person. Because I think oftentimes the first mistake I made was I started immediately acting like an employee again. Does that ever happen to you where you look at the client and you're like, well, you must be the boss, so I'll just do whatever you say?
Yeah, that I can. Yeah, I think I've fallen into that trap, or at least I used to fall into that trap. And that definitely causes problems. I remember the day, not the day it changed for me, but I remember somebody said something to me once, because I was actually suffering with this. You know, I would go in and I would be incredibly nervous about speaking to the new client, you know, as if he was the boss, you know, as if he was,
right,
this is a brand new job, I have to perform, I have to make sure he, you know, I have to make him happy kind of thing, but in a very negative sort of way, you know, not, I want to make the client happy. And I remember one day somebody said to me, you realize that it's, you're interviewing him, right? You know, it's not him interviewing you. You're the one in control. You're interviewing to see whether they should be working with you. It's not the other way around. And that was one little tidbit that sort of helped me sort of lose that nervousness about, well, do you know what, actually, maybe I do have an ounce of power here, or of control over the situation. But anyway, I'm sidelining now, so.
No, I think that's exactly right, because I used to have this, I'm going to become a little crass here. I used to call it the stink of desperation when I would meet a new client or start working with someone. And it was this overwhelming, like, oh, I just want to please. I want to make you happy. I just want to do everything. Like, I'll bend over backwards. And I didn't feel like I had any power. And that desperation sort of came across in the relationship.
Yeah, I think many, many, many people have experienced that. And to be honest, is that part of the excitement? Is it like a misinterpretation of the excitement of the new client? You know, that sort of buzz you get I know from another side of things, whenever I would sort of get a new client or a new lead, should I say, hit my inbox, and I'd always be rushing to get that initial proposal out. Another conversation for another time. New seat proposals, by the way.
I won so many proposals with Nusi. Go ahead. Yes,
there was that sense of desperation of, like, you know, if in this particular case with proposals, you know, if I don't do this right away, if I don't get this done, I'm not going to win that gig. I'm not going to win that contract, and it's all going to be gone. And I'm never going to get another contract again, ever.
So yes, right, because everything's riding on this one.
Yeah, always. So how? I think
I don't know whether it's a miss. It is excitement, but I'm going to go back to, like, the first time I actually remember feeling this. And if you can't see us in person, you have to understand that Nathan is a devastatingly handsome guy. He has always been a cool guy. He has always been a ladies man, I can tell. But if you look at my picture, I am not. We're like polar opposites here. So the first time I started noticing this behavior was actually when I was like 12. Okay. And I noticed that when I liked a girl,
I feel like we're looking at deeper issues here, Marcus.
Yeah, no, we are, right? It all goes back to our childhood. I would start to do things to get this girl in junior high or high school to notice me. And I can tell you that stink of desperation to be noticed, to be liked, was repelling to them. They would run away. And I have got to tell you, I feel like there's some underlying current that when I act that way with a client, they also pick up on it, and it's very unattractive. They just get very nervous, and they think, well, I'm not sure you even are confident enough to do the work, and you seem to want to bow to all of my whims. This isn't going to work, and then the relationship goes sour.
What do you think of some of the messages we send when with that sort of stink of desperation, as you say?
I think that you hit the nail on the head with one of them, and that is that they have all the power, right? When you talked about who's interviewing who, if we walk in and we think, well, I've got to do whatever it takes to win this job, then the reality is we're putting ourselves at a much lower power position, and we're really elevating their importance, whatever they want. And this turns into things like, however you want to pay, whatever price you want to pay, whatever way you want me to bill you, whatever process you want me to use, all kinds of other things that we then leave and go back and we think, why did I do that? I wanted to charge more, and I wanted to use this process that I really trusted. And now I've agreed to a bunch of things that I don't really think are going to work. So maybe that's one of the symptoms, is we tend to agree to things that the client suggests, even though they're not the expert, that we know aren't the right idea.
How did you perhaps go from putting that initial stink out? We'll go past those teenage years and we'll move on to your onto your business years.
But yeah, it took a while. That's pretty painful. Let's pass it.
How did you start to correct that? How did you move from, you know, where's desperate for work? Even if you are desperate for work, you know, how do you move past that perception, that image that you give out to something else?
You know, okay, so I am going to go right back to those teenage years, because I actually started thinking about the guys in my high school who were successful with gals. They oftentimes were the ones that didn't look like they cared if there were girls around or not. I don't know if this resonates with you, but like, I could never figure out how come the guys who seemed like such jerks were always surrounded by the prettiest girls. Well, they exuded confidence and they weren't desperate. So I started to kind of take a play from that book, and I started to think to myself, well, I don't want to be a jerk. I want to be more calm than I had been, because oftentimes I would get very nervous. So I want to try and be calmer, and I want to try and decide up front, you know, what process do I feel is going to be the most successful? For software companies, process was a big deal. And clients would oftentimes say, well, why don't we just do it this way? And at the early days, I would say, okay, we'll do it however you want. But as I got more confident, I would say, no, this is the way we work best. And that phrase, this is the way I work best, was the mark of starting to be thinking of myself as a real professional who could be trusted with a project.
Okay, so instead of them saying, this is everything I need, this is what you need to do to be able to have me as your client, it's you beginning to turn sort of tables a little, you know, and sort of not being forceful in any way, right? Just saying simply, you know, this is the way we work, these are our rates.
I was just going to say, money is a great example, right? I mean, have you ever thought, well, I really hope I can get, you know, this rate, and then you somehow let yourself agree to something much less?
Never happened, ever.
Okay, well, good. Well, I knew you were a cool guy.
Right? No, yeah, that has happened many times. In fact, I had the proposal ready to go out, looked at it, thought, I don't know, and sort of just chinked a few thousand off, which is just ridiculous, you know? Thankfully, I haven't done that in a long, long time, but yes, that used to go on.
You know, I think once I got better at this, I would still go through that proposal review phrase, but I found consistently I would sit down and go, I wonder if I can get 10 grand more. Let's just try it and leave some place for negotiation.
Isn't that awesome when it begins to go the other way, though?
Exactly. And so this idea of actually not fearing negotiation was one of the other hallmarks, is when I started realizing that I could put space and buffer in the project cost, let's say up it by 20,000 or 50,000 or whatever it was, and be okay with the negotiation process that brought it back down. I think that was a mark of confidence, that I wasn't afraid that I was always going to lose during the negotiations.
But I think as well, that says, I think somewhere we've missed something out. If you can get to that point of having the confidence to negotiate a price down, knowing that the client is going to want to negotiate, you've done something right before you get to that point. Because oftentimes, if a proposal goes out and is over budget, what happens? No, it just gets rejected. That's it, full stop.
Right.
And it's very rare that freelance consultant, studio, agency will even hear back unless they reach out. So how do you get to that point where somebody's even willing to negotiate, saying, no, Marcus, actually, we want to work with you and your studio, but there's something going on here with the pricing. Work with me. How did you get to that point? How did you begin to build that relationship of sort of trust, or of setting yourself up as the expert?
Sure. I think you hit the nail on the head. It's about relationship. It's about trust. One of the things I started doing was I stopped sending out proposals so quickly. And what that meant was I still sent just as many over a period of time, but instead of having an initial conversation, hearing, oh, we want a marketing website, oh, we think that, you know, it's going to do X and Y and Z, my first reaction went from initially, let me get you a proposal, thinking that's how I win business, is I spend many, many hours writing all this stuff in a proposal, and then I send it to you, and you'll, in a dream world, you'll sign off on it. And I move that to, well, let's have a second conversation. Let's have a third conversation. Let's collaborate on looking at your site you have now, and let's talk about why you don't like it. It was the idea of taking the time, I guess, instead of rushing into money talks, which I think I did when I was desperate, I would immediately, instead of that, I would start talking more about value and about their needs. And I could make these conversations more about them than they were about me. And that, I think, was part of the process, was really realizing that whenever I was had this stink of desperation, there was this air of self-protection. So it was all about them not violating my boundaries or them not being a jerk to me. And that made it very me-centric. So what I just started to do was realize that I didn't always have to be the first one to send a proposal. Instead, if I could start to really understand their business, that would actually deepen the relationship and give me a better opportunity to win the business.
And did you find that a lot of those clients were actually willing to spend so much time with you, shall we say, up front, rather than, for example, say maybe they were actually talking to several agencies, would they still be willing in the scope of that to say, hey, yeah, let's actually sit down again and let's discuss?
I found that almost everybody likes to talk about themselves. So whether it was a cold RFP, I know, whether it was a cold RFP, I didn't like RFPs where they just came out of the blue. I didn't know where they came from. I felt a lot of times they were just sending it to me to try and get a third bid or whatever. But if they were willing to have a few conversations over the phone or let me talk to the stakeholders, some internal stakeholders, I found I had a chance of winning the business. If they didn't want to have further conversations, then I kind of took that as a red flag where I probably didn't want them as a client.
Yeah, and I think that's gold as well, because I think, you know, if a client can't be bothered to spend time helping you to understand their business so you can help their business, then obviously there's not a foundation for a very solid future, I don't think. It's going to be very hard for them to see any return on investment, isn't it? If, you know, if somebody comes to you and says, you know, we need a new website, this is what we need. We need a homepage and about a contact and whatever. That's it. The budget's whatever it is, 20 grand. Even if you were within budget, even if you knew, even if you were a kick-ass designer and development shop, you're probably going to fail anyway because you have no idea what their business goals are. All you know is they want a new website. But what does that mean? Nothing.
Right. Exactly. I mean, they could go and get a theme off of ThemeForest, right, and have a new website, and it'd look terrible, and it might perform exactly the same way. So I think the other thing is, if you find clients that sort of want to treat you like an employee, that's where I started noticing early on that those were also not the kind of places I wanted to be engaged with.
Okay.
I see two kinds of people in my life right now. It's kind of weird. I see auto mechanics that I need, but I treat them as specialists who just – frankly, and if you're an auto mechanic listening, forgive me, but it's like, just do the brakes on my car and give me the car back for the agreed upon price. I don't want to hear anything else about anything else. I just want the brakes fixed because I don't really trust you, but I can't do the brakes myself. So I'm going to just treat you as somebody who can do brakes. Okay, great. And we're done. No partnership, just financial exchange, money for a brake job. Then I see, and I happen to be building a house. So I was out on the property last night with the builder, and we're walking around. We're looking at the foundation. So the house is just completely open. There's no floor even. And he says, you know, if it were me, I'd spend the money to pour a concrete slab in underneath there. And then you could keep a lot of your seasonal decorations and boxes and kind of an extra storage place. And I said, well, that's a great idea. What's it going to cost? And he quotes me a number, and I go back and I think about it. I say, yeah, that's a great idea. Let's spend that $3,000 that way it's going to cost. And I was so happy that this trusted advisor brought to me this great idea of, you know, if it were me, I see a lot, I do this, and I know a lot of my clients really like that, but it's up to you. That to me is a confidence that comes with being an expert, that comes with knowing that, you know, you've got this relationship to trade on. He wasn't saying, what else do you want, Marcus? He was asserting, I've got some ideas here, and I think you might like some of them.
And you said then about the trusted advisor. I know you're a big fan of that book, right? The Trusted Advisor. If anybody wants to go and check it out, there's... essentially, it's sort of what we're talking about, isn't it? Is how to establish trust as somebody who knows exactly what they're doing and is not just going to force anything on you.
And it really comes from this perspective of, we don't have to be big and showy and talk about how great we are all the time. In fact, in many ways, trust building activities are quiet. They're honest, but they're simply saying, I don't know if you're not sure. And then following it with, but I can find out. or having the confidence to say, you might like this. In my experience, this could be beneficial for you. And letting the client then make the decision. He didn't say, well, I've gone ahead and poured the concrete pad for you and you owe me an extra $5,000. And then we have to, I didn't want that. Well,
that conversation, that might have been a different conversation.
Yeah, to the digital world where you say, well, you really would have wanted it. It would have been stupid to do it without it, right? And then you're like, well, but he wouldn't. And then at the end of the day, you think, well, they didn't pay me properly. He let it be my decision. I just think having that sort of bi-directional respect where you can bring ideas forth, but remember at the end of the day, it's their decision.
You know, once you do have that sort of initial sense of trust, but both ways, you know, that you feel that you can go to them, they can come to you and talk things through as opposed to, you know, make recommendations in a sort of cold printed bullet list on a piece of paper as a client, as a provider. You know, once that relationship has been established and say they've accepted the proposal and they're going forward, you know, and they're going to work with you or your agency, what are some of the things that perhaps we could do to continue that solid sort of client relationship throughout the entirety of the project? Because I know a lot of us, perhaps sometimes once the initial deal has been done, we close down and we go into work mode. You know, we close the door on the cave, we start hacking away on code or designs or whatever, and then we appear a month later with ta-da. That's obviously not a good way to work. So, I mean, what are some of the ways that we can maintain that solid client relationship?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. For me, I used to think the relationship was only important during the selling process. And so I would really focus on it during selling. And then once the contract was signed, I would think, well, great, now I don't have to talk to you for another month until I have something to show. And then in fact, if I ever sort of got behind in my work, then I really didn't want to talk to them. And I guess kept pushing it out and pushing it out and pushing it out. And I would be like, oh, well, I'll just communicate over email. They don't really need a phone call. They probably don't care, you know, as long as I'm not invoicing them for the full amount, they won't care when it's done. And obviously, this is a way to disaster, right? Then when you do show it to them, they're so frustrated, whether it's code or design, that they're frustrated with you and they will not love what you created. Almost guaranteed that the way they feel about you and the way they feel about what you create are somehow tied. So instead of just ignoring them for a month or 2 months or whatnot, set up a weekly meeting. A weekly meeting where all you do is spend 15 minutes touching base, giving project status, asking them, how's it going? Do they have anything that they're bringing? How many websites have died because of content? Well, most of them, frankly. So this is a great place to be saying, how's the content coming? How are the photographs coming, right? And remind them that you're in a collaborative process together. And that also, maybe you can even upsell. I used to have a lot of clients who would say, oh man, the photographs I took look terrible. Well, great, I would think. Why don't you pay me to come in and help you with that? Oh yeah, let's do that. So if you continue to build on relationship by meeting weekly or regularly, by not just hiding behind your email, I think that's one of the biggest mistakes people make. Business owners, you might think that they don't like to talk to you, but they usually are way too busy to be in their email as much as you are. So picking up the phone, having a regularly scheduled time to talk with them and do a project update, even if it's just 15 minutes a week, and get them excited by showing them possibly early versions and getting feedback about your work.
I think that was actually the biggest game changer for my career was I used to do that very thing. I used to go and hide in the back cave until everything was finished and then suddenly turn up and go, here we are, da-da. And it's a nerve-wracking experience for all, you know, them because they haven't seen anything since you began the project, and for me because they hadn't seen anything since the beginning of the project. And yeah, I remember when I started to set up those regular meetings, and I think it was once a week, possibly twice in some cases, depending on the project. It was still nerve-wracking for me because I do get very nervous talking to people that I don't necessarily have a close relationship with. It's not my forte, but I found the more I started to do it, the more I did it with clients, the more I enjoyed it. And it was actually ended up being me who was always pushing for that, you know, saying, you mm-hmm. know, okay, let's set it up in the calendar for next week. You know, I'm thinking that we're going to go in this direction. I'm going to need your help on this, and getting them far more involved in the project, you know, and actually being able to show them the stages of even if it was just a wireframe, you know, and just being able to explain to them, this is what I'm thinking. This is the direction I think after our conversations that we should go in. And it became far more interactive. Pushback went to practically nothing because there was never any surprises. It wasn't It wasn't like, ta-da, what the heck is that? You know, it's just, they almost knew what was coming because it would go from idea, discussion, maybe sketch to wireframe to, you know, here's a little bit of color here. You know, we're thinking about using these kinds of images. Do you have any input there? You know, do you have any of your own photos, as you said? If not, great. I know a guy. That kind of thing. And I just found the process became so much easier. And I enjoyed it so much more as well. I actually came to really enjoy those times where we'd sit down and go through.
Well, and I think that I love the way you put it, ta-da. I used to call it the big reveal. Like my art director would want, I could imagine that he really wanted to like have this this beautiful design that he created. And I always thought he really wants to like cover it in a sheet and then in a big motion, like whoosh, like pull it off and ta-da. And in his mind, the client would always be like, that is like they're crying and they're clapping. And well, almost never happened that way. It was usually surprise. And if you build up the big reveal so much that they can't give you feedback or that any feedback they give you is going to be devastating, right? It's very hard to kind of feel good after that. So mm-hmm. if you give that early, if you go ask for that early feedback, then yeah, you don't get the fun of the big reveal of saying, look, I did it perfect the first time. But what you do get is a client who's willing to give you little bits of feedback so that you get to where he wants to go. I did way too many big reveals early on where the client would look at us like, that's it. That's what you brought. And there was this sense of disappointment and just like, well, I don't think you listen to us at all. And it's because we kind of put all of our eggs into that one basket of the big reveal. If it wasn't perfect, and it almost never was perfect, then it was really devastating for us to hear that, like it wasn't great.
So what about we're involving the client more in the entire process, you know, designing, developing, whatever that might be, marketing campaign, whatever, it doesn't matter. I don't think, you know, once they've pretty much given the okay on that, signed off, you get that final payment, you know, whether you work 50% up front or however you work, there's always something to put in place at the end. And I think a lot of people just leave it there, you know, like a job well done.
If you got paid, that's a job well done.
You got
right?
A job well done, sort of virtual handshakes or maybe a real handshake if you're mm-hmm. living that kind of world. You can tell me what that's like, but I know there are people that do a class job after the job's finished of maintaining relationships. That was also an area that I really sucked in. I'd close a project and that would pretty much be it until the work went dry. And then
I was going to say,
Hey Steve, remember me. I did that great job for you, you know, 12 months ago. How's it going? How's the project going? Has it worked for you? Did we reach your goals? I think you can pretty much see where I'm going with this. I mean,
Oh yeah. And my stomach would oftentimes remind me, you know, you should have talked to Steve 10 months ago, not, you know, or 10 weeks ago, not 10 months ago, because it's going to be so much harder to ask for another project or to really to get him to believe that you care. It's going to feel very salesy if you wait those 10 months, right?
Completely.
So I think that it just, you hit the nail on the head, the amount of time that goes by between interactions. If you let it be many months, then not only are you going to have a harder time going to that person and the next time you talk to them, convincing them that you're not just selling. If you wait a week after the project or 2 weeks, and then you say, I'd like to check and see how the project's performing. Like we had some original goals, and I got to the point where I would always do a 30-day kind of check-in. And I would set this up right from the beginning. So part of the project is 30 days after it launches, we're going to touch base and we're going to find out if it did what you hoped it would do. Because there's always some initial goals, right? And then just check in on a regular basis. It can be an email. I like a conversation. And if you're always asking about the work, it doesn't seem like you're selling as much as you're just sort of saying, hey, like I kind of expect the builder of my house to drop by every once in a while and say, how do you like it? I put a lot of work into it, you know? Sure, at some point I might say, I love it. Can you build me a shed, right? Or can you build me a garage or something like that? But the first few times, he's just going to be reinforcing that he cares, he's there, and he really is interested in me. And I think that's the relationship piece.
I think as well, there is the danger of saying that for the sake of saying it as well. You really need to follow up, because I've been on the other side of, yeah, we'll come and check it out once it's been finished, whatever that might be. I mean, I've just bought a house as well, so I'm very much in tune with builders and, you know, just people saying once they've installed something, yep, we'll come and check it out, and see, and not following through on that.
Yeah, how do you feel?
You've almost done the same thing. Exactly.
Right.
You've almost done the same thing. It's almost as bad as not following up ever. It just means that you don't value me as a client, and I don't feel good about that, especially after I paid all that money.
It feels like a broken promise to me. Especially if you say, oh, we'll follow up in a week and we'll see how that new dishwasher is doing for you. If I don't hear back, I assume that you really are just a liar, frankly, and you don't care. Exactly. Just sales talk.
And I think we're all so wary of sales talk that a lot of the time we are skeptical of that coming true. And then when it doesn't, it's like a double kick in the stomach, because you had sort of trust had been built throughout that relationship, I hope. So definitely want to be following up on those promises.
I remember one time I had a client and I didn't follow up, and I went back to them, and then they said something along the lines of, it's so disappointing that, you know, we haven't heard from you, and now you're just here kind of begging for more work. And we thought we were almost like friends. Like we went and visited them at their office, and they were like, and you never call. And so it was kind of like that. We hoped you were different, but now we see you're all the same as the rest of the jerks in the world. These freelancers and agencies.
You actually had that conversation. Yeah.
Because it was really a matter of, in our heart, I think they weren't our favorite client, even though we said all kinds of nice things. You ever have a relationship where they think that, you know, it feels pretty good, but you really aren't enjoying it as much as you portray?
No.
And never. So, okay, well, if you ever did,
what yes, you might yes, find yes, of course,
is that you're actually like fooling the other person. And in this case, the person said, I thought you were different than everybody else. All these other agencies that made promises, and, you know, now it seems like you're just like everybody else. And that kind of stuck with me. It felt bad.
Yeah, I can imagine that. That's not a pleasant conversation to have. I remember actually, I think the bar has been set pretty low for people like us in the creative space, whether you are a freelance, whether you are an industry, sorry, an agency studio, the bar has been set very low. So I don't think it's that hard, you know, to take that customer to a different place, to a different experience. I remember one client of mine had compared us web designers to used car salesmen. I have to say, he wasn't talking about me at the time, but he gave his thoughts on how he and others perceived our industry. And he said that we were seen as worse than used car salesmen. And I think that has just stuck with me and have never, ever left me. You know, so the bar has been set so low. I think it's really easy for anybody, you know, in our industry to just take it up just a notch or two, you know, and you're going to stand head and shoulders above the rest.
That is such a good point. I actually remember when I first had my agency, I walked up and down Main Street in our little town. And Main Street, it sounds like it might be the main street, but it's pretty small. And I walked into this jewelry store, and I just was cold walking and introducing myself. And I said, hi, I've started this new web development company. You know, have you thought about putting up a website? And the guy said to me, why should I believe you'll call me? The last guy won't return my calls at all, and I'm willing to pay him. You all are a bunch of, you know, you can go from there. So, and I remember just looking at him thinking, you don't even know me. But in the same way, he was painting anybody who would kind of walk in and try and sell him, especially one of these web developers or these digital agencies. We were just like the car salesman. You couldn't be trusted. So you're right. There's a huge opportunity to just be a little bit more disciplined, to care a little bit more, and to invest a little bit more of yourself. And I think you do really stand out. I am actually currently so disappointed with a couple of contractors, and I still just wish they weren't like they didn't just disappear off the face of the earth as though wherever they lived was just zapped by a laser beam. Sometimes they do, and it drives me crazy.
Yeah, I think Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think just taking up that notch or two is going to make the world a difference. I mean, we just finished making our first hire now at Nusi. And right from the very beginning, the guy we chose just took it that extra step each time. He just over-delivered from the beginning. Before we even asked him to deliver anything, he was over-delivering. And I think it just, that stands out, you know. And I think today in such a competitive world, it's you have to stand out in one way or another.
Yeah, and I'm curious with this guy you just hired, when you talk about over-delivering, was it like a huge amount of effort for him to over-deliver? Or was it just that what did he really do to over-deliver in your mind?
Was it a huge amount of work or effort? No, I don't think so. It's just we received about 150 job applications for the role that we were advertising for. And it's very easy to become CV blind after after a certain number. And this email sort of popped up in the inbox. First of all, it was really nicely written. It wasn't the same old, here are my list of qualifications. It wasn't everything. But it just said there was a link halfway down that said, I've made a quick video intro for you that I thought you might appreciate. And so it linked up to a little online video recording service and said, for starters, it said, hello, Nathan and Michael. Which, believe me, when you're hiring for a position and you keep hearing, dear hiring manager, dear Nusi team, hello, full stop, it just made a world of difference, you know. And he just gave this brief 2-minute intro to himself and how he was excited to come on and join the team. And that was just, right from the very beginning, that was like, yeah, we like this guy. And it just snowballed from there. That was just the beginning, really. So, but anyway, I think there's so many ways that you can build a client relationship right from that get-go.
And that's the place to start, right? Don't act desperate. Think about what you want in advance of the client meeting. What are you willing to give? Where will you negotiate? And where will you simply say, no, I don't work that way, in a really calm and yet confident manner? Mm-hmm. What rate do you want for your services? And are you willing to come down on it? Or is it, and how do you want to bill? Because oftentimes clients say, well, we only pay hourly, or we always pay at the end of the month, or at the end of the, like, they will come with some idea about terms. You need to think in advance about what you want and what works for you. And then simply be willing to say, well, that's not the way I work. And, you know, here's my reasoning why. It can't all be about you. Think about the benefits that are to both sides about the way you work.
Fantastic. All
right. Well, yeah, I think you're right. The bar is really low. So doing a little bit, I just want to recap that, because I think that's not said often enough in our industry. People who, if I could get one attribute in a freelancer, just one, it would not even be skill. It would be dependability. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't care if I get the very best designer or coder on the planet, but I need somebody who is dependable and who I can talk to. And that, I think that's where there's so many people falling down.
Fantastic. Well, as we said at the beginning, we're going to be doing a few of these episodes together. So we're going to be discussing a few different topics. Before we just finish and say goodbye, you just released your book, right?
I did, yeah. 7 Habits That Ruin Your Technical Team. It's available on LeanPub, and you can find it on MarcusBlankenship.com as well. Under this, I think it's under the services page. Nathan informed me right before this. He said, "Man, your book applies to creative people too. You've mistitled it, so I'm going to have to really think about the title." But it's 7 ways that that people who are leading any kind of other, I think, expert can oftentimes hurt the relationship with the people they're leading, whether they're freelancers, contractors, or full-time people.
Yeah, I think the book is totally applicable to any creative business. Anybody who's running a team, I think, is definitely applicable, and some really, really good advice in there. So go and check that out. Right, we'll be back next week with a different guest next week, but I'll leave that till then. Nice little surprise for everyone. And yeah, thank you very much, Marcus. We'll be speaking again soon, all right?
Take care. Thanks, everybody.
Cheers, man.